Okay, up next, if you can hear me now, up next is George Blood, and he's the president of the Safe Sound Archive.
It's Adrian, cuts right to the chase.
There you go.
So I was talking to Mike a couple of months ago, in December. My wife and I celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary, and we spent all of the last 25 years raising five adorable children, two of whom are in college and two in graduate school this year. So I'm going to take this 35 minutes to teach everybody how to have a happy marriage and raise five children and afford college. I'm going to actually maybe take on a more time-consuming task and try to teach everybody how to play back analog tape. Making the point that this is really meant to be just an introduction to give people a background. I like to think of it in terms of what does a collections manager need to know to be informed when talking on this subject, to know when a vendor or an employee, an engineer is snowing them, or to do basic assessment. That's the threshold. And certainly not to get you to the point where you can be the even-numbered examples instead of the odd-numbered examples that Michael just showed us. Let's start at the beginning. Sine wave. This is, if we could see sound as it travels through air, it wouldn't look like this. This is just a mathematical representation of the increase and decrease over time of air pressure that we perceive as sound. You can think of it like this, that the little circles represent more air particles under higher pressure, grouped together, and then it dissipates and then it comes back together. Happens to do that really, really fast, but the sine wave is just a mathematical representation of more or less, or up and down. The pressure goes up, the pressure goes down. And we can, this happens to be the way it happens in air. We can look at it this way, where the pluses are positive magnetization or negative magnetization, or positive and negative voltage. That it goes up and it goes down. And it is that transduction from air to electricity to magnetic information being stored on magnetic tape. This, if you can make these out, this is a view of a magnetic viewer. This is a little tool that you can put on the tape and actually see what's on it. You can do other exciting things like put it on the back of your credit card and see how that information is stored. And this on the left, you can see the traces are narrower, and on the right, they're fatter. This is a comparison of quarter and half track. This is a tool that you can use to do a preliminary analysis of the program that you're dealing with. The example that Michael showed probably consisted of a tape that was originally recorded on half track and was over-recorded in quarter track. This is a close-up, and you can see the banding of the light and dark areas, and that's the up and down, the positive and negative, the dark and light areas of the modulation of the magnetic signal that is the representation of that increasing and decreasing pressure in air that we perceive as sound. There's also, you can do this in other ways. This is the way it's done in film tracks, optical film tracks, where it's bright and dark and goes up and down. And this actually happens to be handy for our purposes today because I can use this as an introduction to this representation on the right. So the representation on the right would be a full track recording with the dark and light banding being the changes that we have in the magnetic information as it represents the sine wave. Michael already mentioned azimuth, and this is probably the big money adjustment. The choosing and setting up the azimuth is probably the single where you have the single largest impact in the entire digitization process. This is probably on the order of going between not from a 96 kilohertz sampling rate to 44.1, but you can easily go down to a 10 kilohertz sample rate pretty fast by having the adjustment wrong. And azimuth is the perpendicularity of the playback head or the record head to the tape by definition. And in the left, if you can see the blue line, it aligns perfectly with the banding as it goes by. So that you're looking at with the tape head just one instant in time as the tape goes over the head. If the azimuth, the head is tilted, then as you can see on the right, you'll be looking at more than one of those positive and negative areas concurrently. And I've tried to draw that line so such that half of the line is in a white area and the other half is in the black area. And the head doesn't know what part is looking at, what part of the head is looking at what part of the tape. So it just takes whatever is coming past it and averages out all the magnetic information and puts out a signal. So in this case, nothing would come out. And unlike my presentation on Thursday, this is bad. So, but this assumes, you know, a perfect vertical alignment of your playback head assumes that the original was recorded perfectly. And that's a very dangerous assumption to make, because more often than not, that it'll be skewed. The information as it's recorded on the tape can be exceedingly small. That's actually this next slide. This is just a little bit of arithmetic that the range of our hearing, most commonly cited as being 20 to 20 kilohertz, you can see how incredibly small that information is as it's recorded on the tape. So that as those dark and light bands get narrower and narrower, closer to closer together, the need to adjust the azimuth to a finer and finer degree becomes more and more important. So if we have, as we do on the left, a misaligned recording, this was for whatever reason a cheap machine, it was recorded in the wilds of Borneo under difficult circumstances, or a machine just wasn't aligned, or somebody didn't know what they were doing there. Who knows why the machine wasn't recording properly in the first place. If you play it back correctly, with the perfect playback azimuth, you're not getting optimum playback. On the right, within the limits of the drawing tools in PowerPoint, which are pretty dismal, that line's actually supposed to be at the same angle as the light and dark. You misadjust your playback machine to align it to the tape. This is a very simple diagram of what happens in a magnetic recording or playback head. If we all go back and remember it right after lunch as we're trying not to nod off, the right-hand rule from high school physics, that you take an electronic signal, send it through a coil, it'll induce a magnetic signal in the iron, and at the top of the of our trapezoid there, there's a little gap, and we actually call it the gap, that allows the magnetic field to escape. And this is, very simply put, how the rising and falling magnetic information is encoded on the tape, which is sensitive to the changes in magnetic flux in the same way that optical film is sensitive to changes in light. But as simple as that diagram is, and as easy as it appears on paper, of course, it doesn't work quite that simply. Because although we have purposely left that gap so that the magnetic field can escape and imprint the tape, and this just happens in the reverse. You run the magnetic signal on the tape over the head, it induces the magnetic current in the trapezoid, and that induces the electrical current that allows us for playback. So although we've purposely left that gap there to let the magnetic signal out, it doesn't just escape on the top, it escapes on the sides. So that trapezoid that we had, we're now looking down on it, so right through the tape into the magnetic head. And the signal escapes out the sides. Now this is an exaggeration because some people are very far from the screen, but you can see conceptually that magnetic field is escaping out the sides as well as out of the top. And for that reason, when we have, in this case, two tracks, and we have stereo here, the heads will talk to each other or read the signal that the other is trying to see. We call this crosstalk, but we want to try to minimize that. The tracks on the tape have different configurations for different purposes. So in the examples that I showed at the beginning, the view of the magnetic viewer, we have two little tracks on the tape on the left-hand picture and two larger tracks in the right-hand picture. The tapes, the tracks are laid out in a variety of different forms. So this is not a picture of a head stack on the tape machine. This is just the same head multiple times, showing a comparison of the different widths that are occupied on the tape. So if you can think of it, the oldest recordings just recorded all the way across the tape. To get more information on the tape, you divide the tape in half. So you record on half the tape, or half track, record down one length, flip the tape over, record on the other side. Or you can record on both tracks simultaneously, and thus board stereo recording. So you take the tape, you divide it in half, but you don't literally get half the tape because you have to avoid that problem of leakage, the crosstalk. And then you can divide it yet again in the quarter track, which you can either use to put four tracks on the tape or record two tracks in one direction, two tracks in the other direction. And this is a graphic that Mike Casey lent me from, is this Facet or Sound Direction? Facet. So you can see, recorded in full track all the way across the tape, or divide the tape in half, record down one direction, turn around, come back, record it together. This creates this desirability of having the guard band creates some anomalies because the tracks don't get divided up evenly. It's we make the track width as wide as we can because that improves the audio performance, but we need to make the guard bands wide enough to minimize the crosstalk. And this is one of Richard Hess's graphics. You can see, again, we've got full track, and then three versions of half track, and on the end, quarter track. Notice how in the topmost track, that lines up all the way across a half track. But the third track, which would be the right channel in a quarter track stereo recording, doesn't quite line up with a half track. So this is where you begin to see material anomalies playing back quarter track tapes on a half track machine and vice versa. So tools like the magnetic viewer that say, well, it's only recorded in one direction, it must be half track, is not a safe assumption. So it could very well just be a quarter track machine that was only, quarter track tape was only recorded in one direction. So that's why when you have a half track tape played on a quarter track machine or vice versa, you end up with an anomaly, vastly reduced gain in the right channel. Equalization curves. Gary Galo gave us a presentation in the last session on EQ curves for discs. The majority of recording technologies employ some form of equalization curves. And this is a way to optimize the systems. Well, there's a battle between the low frequencies, the base information. Those frequencies are very big. They take up a lot of space. And the high frequencies, which are weak, but need to be preserved because our ear is very sensitive. So very simply, what you can do is take the low frequencies and make them not so loud. Take the high frequencies and make them louder before you record them onto your medium. By making the low frequencies smaller, they don't take up so much space and leaves more space for the high frequency signal. Let's look at one of the primary benefits of using an equalization. This is specifically a pre-emphasis curve. And we'll look at just the effects on high frequency. Number one on here is our original signal. Low frequencies on the left, high frequencies on the right, and it is unadjusted. It's flat. And that's why we call it flat. In the second diagram, we've taken and electronically we've boosted the high frequencies. We've just made them louder. You saw Gary's presentation, you'll understand that these what actually happens is far more sophisticated than this. These pictures are greatly simplified. So you turn the high frequencies up, and then in three, we've put that altered signal onto a recording medium. Tape, disc, early digital formats use this. FM radio still uses this. So in the third part, we have the altered signal and the artifacts of the carrier, the noise. When we go to play that back, we invert the process. We turn the high frequencies back down. But since something has happened in the meantime, namely we've recorded it on some noisy media, we not only turn down the high frequencies that are a part of the original signal, but also the high frequencies that are an artifact, the noise of the carrier. But not only do we receive this benefit of the greater noise reduction that comes from using pre-emphasis, we also have this new challenge of matching the equalization curves in playback to the original. In addition to the information that Gary was showing us about how there's a lack of standards in the world of discs, but we have only a few standards for this in analog tape. However, the challenge is, was the machine properly aligned? Because they're mechanical things, and they wear over time, and the component values change. And different manufacturers make their tape in different ways. And so aligning the machine to the tape during the recording is separate from merely aligning the electronics the way they're supposed to be. And unless there are test tones on the tape, which is common in a professional environment, you would put at least three alignment tones, a low frequency tone of 100 hertz, a mid frequency 1 kilohertz, and a high frequency 10 kilohertz. These are references to allow at playback to adjust the playback machine to the original. That information is rarely present in the overwhelming majority of materials in archives. So there's two parts to the equalization. One is, where was the tape recorded? What is its provenance? Do we use the proper equalization standard? But we are probably not, unlike azimuth, able to ascertain what the equalization condition of the record machine was. So at this point, there gets to be some judgment on the part of the playback engineer. as to, was that just badly recorded, or was there a misalignment that I can correct for? Should I correct for it? Should I have the machine aligned to standard and document that we're playing back to standard and making no assumptions about what the original was and how we have changed it? I'm going to pause for a minute and see if there are any overwhelming questions before I get into specific formats. You already know this. What do you want? Gary.
If I could just make one point about equalization in tape, there's another thing that goes on here which is affects the type of playback equalization that we apply. A magnetic tape head, playback head, like a magnetic phono cartridge, is a velocity-sensitive transducer. And the response of the magnetic playback head rises with frequency from the low end to the top end until the wavelengths are too short to bridge the gap. Mm-hmm. And then it falls off very, very rapidly. The high frequency boost we apply in playback is to compensate for that roll off where the wavelengths are too short to bridge the gap. But then the cutback that we apply in playback is to compensate for that rising response of the head itself. So there's two things going on with the tape equalization. It's the response of the playback head itself in addition to compensating for
right.
the equalization that we're applying in recording.
Jay?
George, is there also a difference in bias frequencies for different types of systems?
Yes, but it does not concern us for playback. Azimuth has no impact upon playback unless you're trying to extract the bias frequency to do speed adjustment, which is another topic. But simply put, bias is something that is part of the record chain, but not part of the playback chain.
I think you said museum wrap.
Museum wrap?
Library wrap.
Library wine?
Library wine?
Library wine consists of two aspects. One is that the tape is stored in play mode so that there's a very even pack and very even tension so that you don't want pop strands and scatter wind, and that the tension throughout the whole tape, and I've got some pictures of what happens when the tension isn't even. Those are coming up really, really soon. And the other is that the tape would be stored tails out. Now, if it's recorded in both directions, there's a limit to what you can do. You make a judgment call in there. But tape is subject to print through. It's inherently sensitive to magnetic signals. And then with each revolution of the tape, you put magnetically encoded material next to magnetically sensitive material. And there's a tendency for particularly very strong magnetic signals to imprint upon adjacent layers of tape. It's called print through. This is a bit of a thought experiment. If you have a very loud signal, da 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 dum, it's very loud and then it's soft, and you wrap that around the reel so that it comes all the way around to the fermata, you'll hear a ghosting of the loud signal imprinting upon the quiet signal. And if you have the tape heads out, where you just put it on and it plays, and thread the tape machine up, hit play, and you hear the signal, then that loud signal will imprint upon the tape that comes before. And you get a phenomenon called pre-echo, where you hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. By leaving the tape tails out, where you put it on, you have to rewind it, you get the opposite effect. And the print-through happens where there is other signal. And the other signal, what follows, masks or hides or is strong enough to overcome the print through. So that the point of winding tapes tails out is to avoid pre-echo in the print through.
But you said stored in play mode. Is play mode Same thing.
It's tails out. Yes. So there's a head and a tail.
Yeah, I understand.
Head being the front.
I've just never heard of play mode.
Play mode. Library wind. In play mode, in that you could fast forward it to the end to avoid the print through problem, but you'd have scatter wind. I'm going to touch on the omnipresent Philips compact audio cassette because, as comparatively low fidelity medium it is, it's a fairly simple thing from a preservation standpoint, except for the issue of azimuth. Almost all of the common problems with the Philips compact cassette are mechanical, and you can solve the overwhelming majority of them very quickly by changing the shell. This is getting to be progressively more and more difficult because it's hard to get empty cassette shells, particularly quality ones. But if you find you're having a problem playing a cassette, the simple thing is to run down to the local store, buy, spend $5, $8 on a nice cassette tape, take it back, open it up, throw the tape away, and put the tape from the problem cassette into the new shell.
Make sure they use screws.
I'm getting there. So there are lots of things that happen. If you turn a cassette over and look at the business end, these cassettes are B-wound. They're oxide out. So that when you turn them out, the oxide is facing the heads when the head assembly comes in contact with the tape. And behind the tape is a felt pad, wool or something like that, and a brass spring that is used to keep the pressure of the pressure pad against the tape to maintain the tape to head contact. And those will rust or fall out. And guess what? The tape that you just spent $8 for at Walgreens, it comes with a new one. Just use the whole thing. The shells, particularly inexpensive ones, deform very easily, separate from leaving them on the dashboard of the car in August. And inside, there are little rollers that rust. The slip sheets that enable the tape to move within the shell wear out. And if the tape's deformed, it's probably because there's a problem with the shell. If the tape is broken or stretched, it's due to a mechanical problem. And here we have a picture of two types of cassettes, is what Steve was just referring to. They're assembled in either of two ways. They're either screwed together, which is a good thing, or they're sonic welded. There's a screw in each of the four corners, and the one that's always the bugger is the one in the middle here. That's the one that you'll forget, why it won't still come apart. So there are five screws. The one on the right has been sonic welded. You take two pieces of plastic, put them against each other, apply a very high frequency, about 100 kilohertz usually, very high amplitude. The halves of the two pieces of plastic vibrate at this very high frequency, and they friction against each other until the edge melts and they're bonded together. Those are a pain to get apart. They're also the ones that usually fail and you need to, they're cheap cassettes, so you need to migrate. Everybody in my shop has a different favorite routine. One of my guys likes to take a putty knife and a 20-ounce hammer and split them and just fire them. Well, I like to take two big wrenches and just tear them apart. We have found that if you try to be really ginger with it, you just end up handling it more. And the more you handle it, and the more you try to stay away from the tape, it's like taking a Band-Aid off. Just be done with it. Let's get into some basic traits of reel-to-reel tape. They come in a variety of speeds. They come in a wide variety of speeds. And this is one of the challenges that archives will find, is that you'll go out and spend some serious money on a nice tape machine to find that half of your tapes are a different speed. And we hear tales of all kinds of solutions to this. I was visiting a site last week, actually, where they had a machine that was 7.5 and 15 inches per second, but the tapes were 1 7/8. So their solution was to copy the tapes from 7.5 to a dictation transcription cassette machine that they could adjust the speed and turn it down. But at least they got the speed down so that they could then digitize the signal. That's a bad idea. That's not just the hard way. That's far from best practice, I would say. And they come in all kinds of variety of sizes, from very small to very large. And the very large ones are usually from either a professional environment or a serious hobbyist. And as the sizes get smaller, they get into probably field recordings on a small portable machine. But we still want long recordings. So the professionals, they want the high fidelity. They use the big reels to run the tape at very high speed. Whereas you get into the field, you know, carrying more tape or just the recording length. So we end up with this paradox that the smaller the reel, the longer the tapes tend to be, because they use slower and slower speeds. This is an oversimplification, and arithmetically, you know, it's the difference between running a 10-inch reel at 7.5 or 15 inches per second, you get half an hour on that big reel, and running a 3 or 5-inch reel at 1 7/8 and getting 8 hours on a reel. So this is the question that you face in RFPs all the time. We have 1,000 tapes, we'd like you to digitize them. How long are they? You know, are they 1,015 IPS 10-inch reels, or are they 5 1 7/8 or 15 16 tapes, in which case there's a lot of sound on there. So a lot of things you need to know about in basic church. And yes, you probably won't be able to discover it all, but any of this information that you can collect is valuable in finding out a lot of information that informs the process of transfer. So we've talked about difference in speeds, different sizes, different thicknesses. The professional tapes are 1.5 mils thick, and 1 mil is very common. In a large reel, you could say it's a difference between an hour and a half. Reducing by a third gets you 50% more duration on the tape. And half mil tape, which is a complete terror in almost every regard, is very common. So again, if you're looking at the how long are the tapes and the smaller reels, you know, length is everything. Thank you, whoever giggled. Sorry about that, Chuck. These tapes are very fragile. They print through very easily. They stretch really easily. And then we have this variety of track formats. So these are the balls that are in the air, even before you grab for your azimuth wrench, even before you try to figure out the equalization. And this is much less common, but archives will see this. They come in different thicknesses. This is a reel of 2-inch tape and a reel of 1-inch tape. The larger reel weighs 25 pounds. And these are multi-track tapes. Very occasionally, you'll see some unusual things like 1-inch two-track. But these are multi-track tapes used in usually pop music production, used in film production, used in radio production. All kinds of stuff will show up at your doorstep, as I'm sure you've long since learned. One of the nice things about the big reels is that they come apart. This is really useful. They're held together by 3 screws, usually. And this is handy because some of the things that you'll encounter, like the tape gets loose and gets jammed between the side of the tape pack and the flange, and rather than trying to gingerly wiggle that out, just take the reel apart. You'll also find that some reels are not created equal. So you end up with really cheap flanges that are badly bent, and rather than fighting that reel, you can replace the flanges. About 6 months ago, finished a large project. It was 1,100 reels that all wanted to be rehoused. They were plastic reels or flanges or worse. And we were able to find enough flanges, but they were making them for us in the quantity that we needed. The hubs were really hard to get. And when I needed 10 more to finish the job, I had to buy the whole case of 400. So, and the screws are, the screws for some reason happen to be easy enough to get. But this is the end of the life of analog being demonstrated by the difficulty in getting the pieces. Like,
I'd like to tell you that the Voice of America has just surplused a couple of panelists.
We'll talk. Okay, so we have on the right, the other thing that you find with the reels that come apart is particularly in like college radio stations, the reels are expensive. So if you can take them apart and reuse the pieces, then you can save some money. So you'll often see pancakes of tape without sides on them. You want to be really careful handling those. Seth has told us a tale this morning. Bad things happen. This reel came to us. This has got a hysterically long tail that goes with it. And you can see the very well-meaning people who have this disaster ran out to Kmart and got some wooden clothespins to clamp around the outside to try to keep this from getting worse. How much time do we get? Okay. All right. I'm about halfway through my slides. So I'm going to breeze through the salient points of what remains. Principally, I'm talking about the distinction between acetate and polyester tapes. Tape is made in layers, sort of like a sandwich, where you've got the iron oxide, which is sensitive to the magnetic signal. This is essentially rust. That's in a binder, a glue, if you will. And this isn't like a layer of rust and a glue that holds it to the base. It's a slurry, it's a stew that has, it's all mixed together, that's coated on the tape. And tape is identified by its base. And it's usually either acetate-based or polyester, although there are other, the earliest tapes are paper, and there are also some less common things like PVC tape. Which has a very different composition. But there are other things too, but most tape is acetate or polyester. And it's important to be able to differentiate between them because their failure modes and their behavior is different. But there's a very simple way of doing it, namely that acetate tape is made from the same stuff that they make acetate film from, which means it's translucent. It's made, one of its desirable properties is that it's translucent. So you can see the reel on the right, you can see some light shining through. But on the left, it's opaque. And this is probably 99% good enough to tell you whether you've got acetate or polyester tape, because sometimes you'll get half mil tape, which will just be thin, and, because it's so thin, we'll let some light through it. This is the textbook way of telling between acetate and polyester tape. Acetate tape in particular is hydroscopic. Absorbs moisture, and it absorbs it very unevenly. So you end up with phenomena like this. The one on the right actually was bathed. The one on the right, which is actually film, just shrank sitting on the shelf. This is a really nice picture of it in a less advanced stage. That causes cupping and skewings, as Steve had asked. Question of Chuck earlier about the this will cause the tape to not play back evenly. Tape to head contact is a problem. These are all attributes of acetate tape, and it breaks down like acetate film and develops a smell of vinegar called vinegar syndrome. Vinegar syndrome is highly autocatalytic and highly infectious. So that if you've got a reel that's pickling, the reels around it will catch the cold, and the more it's in that box, and the worse the deterioration gets, the faster it'll get. There is a treatment for this. Kodak makes molecular sieves. You can buy them from most archival supply houses and you throw a sachet in, it looks like silica gel. It's a different chemical, but it'll absorb the off-gassing of the vinegar, the acetic acid, it smells like vinegar, and slow down the deterioration. Polyester, by comparison, is opaque, but it handles very, very nicely. It's a huge leap forward in the technology that, broadly speaking, under similar circumstances, polyester tape will sound better than acetate tape, although, you know, in the right hands, they're both can do amazing things. But they're dimensionally, it's much more dimensionally stable. You don't see the same kinds of problems of the tape shrinkage. But it doesn't stretch, it breaks. Another way to tell the difference between acetate tape and polyester tape is that acetate tape breaks, and usually pretty cleanly. It's you can splice that back together, whereas polyester tape just stretches. And no, that can't be fixed. Polyester tape also suffers from the sticky shed syndrome, which I'm out of time for. This is where the polyester or the polyurethane binder exposed to moisture breaks apart, and there are loose ends of the binder exposed on the surface of the tape makes the tape squeal. This is the standard test for it. The tape should wind very easily off the end of the reel, and if it sticks, as you can see on the left, it's sticking to itself. You'll get false negatives, but not false positives for this. If the tape is sticking to itself, you have a sticky shed. The good news about this is that the problem is an issue of moisture, of humidity, rather than temperature, and the chemistry is reversible, so that you can do things to the tape to make it less sticky. We find in our climate controlled vault that if we leave the tapes in there long enough, and we're running, when I left, it was sitting at about 28% RH, the tapes largely cure themselves. This is where tape baking comes in, and there are a variety of other things that I'm happy to be out of time to discuss with regards to the sticky shed. So I'm gonna give Eric all the time that he deserves. Thanks.